Greetings and welcome to Trottle Up. This is a radio show and podcast that showcases critical thinking and complex problem solving. And it is designed to inform, delimit, empower, and amaze. Now, all aboard the Trottle Up Express, powered by High Velocity Reason, and I am your host, Captain Kevin Smith, U.S. Navy retired. Now, I'm a naval aviator and former squadron commander and Top Gun instructor as a naval aviator. And also, I'm a pioneer in the field of some aspects of critical thinking and complex problem solving, and of course, high velocity reason. Now, our tagline for the show is to accelerate beyond the ordinary. So we could say that we are not ordinary thinkers, you and I, but we are different and we are out of the box thinkers. Our motto for the show is to employ high velocity reason to achieve high octane performance. And in a nutshell, that basically means to stay out ahead of the problem. That's particularly important if we want to achieve success. Now, our mission statement for the show, and this changes a little bit from time to time, but this is a pretty good mission statement, is to provide our listening audience with a relatively easy yet effective way to strengthen our power of reason through the employment of critical thinking. Now, our website, the address here is throttleupradio.com. That's throttleupradio.com. That's the address for the website. And before we close on our introduction, I wanted to say that our audio engineering services is provided by Evergroove Studios, and they are located in Evergreen, Colorado, which is right outside of Denver on the west side. Highly recommend their services for anyone who wants to get involved with audio. It could be any kind of audio that you might have in mind, including music, by the way. Also, graphics artist services and media support is provided by Reflections Printing, and the gal is Jennifer. She heads up this organization, and she owns it as well. And Jennifer does a great job with all of our media support, is a fantastic graphics artist and media production specialist, and her phone number is 435-574-0422. That's 435-574-0422. And before we close the introduction, I want to say that the show is typically organized into three parts. So part one of Throttle Up is critical thinking, or an ongoing discussion of various aspects of critical thinking and complex problem solving. Part two is our storyboard, and the storyboard is a story of America, or a story of Americans, story of an individual. It could be any kind of story, but it all relates to trying to get our arms around this whole thing, which we call critical thinking and complex problem solving. And then part three is our radio essay. Now, our radio essay is typically a little bit more in-depth treatment of a particular subject. We do not intend for this to be boring. But for those who would like a little bit more info on certain things that we cover in part one and part two, then part three typically is a way for us to get a little bit further into a subject matter and understand it better. Okay, all aboard the Throttle Up Express. This is a place where all critical thinkers and complex problem solvers are welcome with open arms.
Now,
Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up. After that formal introduction, we are back for another special edition. And so this is entitled Critical Thinking in Business Operations, Part 3. It is a special edition of Throttle Up. The reason for that is because, I guess the short answer would be, is because it's important and it's needed. And the longer, there is a longer answer, which is critical thinking and complex problem solving are now considered to be the number one set of in-demand skills in the global job market. Also, in a survey conducted by the Wall Street Journal, 900 executives were contacted, and 92% of those said that, or responded to this survey, said that critical thinking was as important or more important than any technical skills that the employee would bring to the table. All right, so that's pretty profound stuff, and that's the whole reason why we have Throttle Up. That's the whole reason for the existence of Throttle Up Radio. And it really is, I guess, in a sense, one of the main reasons why I do the things that I do, which is to try to promote this idea and to get others to promote it as well. There's no reason why others can't contribute to this body of knowledge and begin to promote it in various ways, lots of ways to do it. One of the easiest ways to do it right now is producing or creating short videos. It's very easy to do, and it's very easy to post it on the YouTube website or other places. And so that's a great way to get information out there. I know that Jordan Peterson has used that quite effectively over the years. And so that's the whole idea. All right. So this special edition, this is part three of Critical Thinking and Business Operations. Now, I use the word business very loosely here. And we talked about this last week also. You could be in the business of anything, right? And so I'm using it very loosely. I'm not necessarily talking about an economic enterprise, although primarily so, but it could be, you could be in the business of space flight. You could be in the business of conducting military operations. Whatever is your profession, whatever is your job title, whatever is your preferred activities in terms of how you spend your productive time. And so this week we have, first off, I should say that this will probably be one more in this series, probably be four, might be a little bit more than that. It could be more than four, but we're planning on four right at the moment. And so this is part three. We're going to be talking about Dietrich Dorner's book, The Logic of Failure, a little bit about that. And then we continue with our discussion of space operations. We're going to be talking about Apollo 13, which is a fantastic story in and of itself. I know most of you, like me, has seen that movie. I've seen it actually a number of times. I think it was directed by Ron Howard, if I remember right. And then we're going to be looking at the Challenger accident and the Columbia accident. So we're going to be looking at space operations, and why are we going to be doing that? We're going to be doing that to look at what worked and what didn't work. There's some really interesting and fascinating lessons with respect to Apollo 13 in terms of what actually did work. But we are going to look at some accidents like we did last week. We discussed in some measure of detail a Deepwater Horizon disaster. the reason why we look at things like that is so that we can all learn. And so those who were affected by it, we're going to honor their, could be their sacrifice, honor their loss of life by seeing if we can figure out how to prevent things like that from occurring in the future. Okay, so, and before I leave that train of thought, I'm going to say up front that I don't have all the answers. I would like to encourage my listening audience to think about things and to consider what's the best way to go forward. I have some ideas here, but I don't have all the ideas, all right? And so this is really kind of a work in progress as we move forward into this, which I call a new intellectual frontier. It is looking at problems as a, or it is looking at the ability to find solutions to complex problems is a major human activity, and it ought to be professionalized. So we ought to have a group of professionals who can do such a thing, armed with the necessary tools and processes and support structures, and to create what I call, create a cadre of elite problem solvers. And all of us can become elite problem solvers. It's not just reserved for the chosen few. Every single one of us, it doesn't matter where you are in the organization, it doesn't matter where you are in the hierarchy, every single one of us can become a very capable and very productive elite problem solver. And so that's where I'm moving, and that's the whole purpose of what we're trying to do here. Okay, so let's jump right in to the chapter one of this special edition. And we have four chapters, which we may get to all four. I kind of doubt we're going to get to all four, but we have four chapters. If we don't get to all four today, we'll do it next week in the next edition. Okay, so chapter one is The Logic of Failure, and that's a book by the name by the author of that book, which is called The Logic of Failure, is Dietrich Dorner. I have used this book before. It's probably in my view, and I've read been involved in this for a very long period of time. It's probably one of the best books ever written about why things fail and what we can do about it. The subtitle of it is Recognizing and Avoiding Error in Complex Situations. Okay, so my position is, yes, we want to recognize and avoid error, but we do that by employing what I would call critical thinking up front. Okay, we arm ourselves with the ability to think critically. That's one of the keys to success, in my view. Right? Now, does that mean that we also need to have some technical expertise? Perhaps, but not necessarily or not exclusively. We may not necessarily need to have technical expertise. What we need to be able to do is we need to be able to think critically in complex business operations. That's what we need to do. All right, so let's press on. Now, I'm going to be reading this, and it really is fascinating, and I want to do it justice, and so I'm going to be reading this this introduction to this book, and it really kind of sets the stage, and I think it's one of the best short descriptions of of complex problem solving and what happens when it does not go well, when the attempts to solve a complex problem or the attempts to deal with a complex situation doesn't go well. What can we do and how should we think about it? So Dietrich Dorner starts off in his introduction this way. He says, "We were in high spirits. The physicist laughed as he told his story. Everybody had agreed on the proposed plan. The mayor had the support of both the citizens and the city council because the volume of traffic downtown and the resultant noise and air pollution had become intolerable. The speed limit was lowered, therefore, to 20 miles per hour, and speed bumps were installed to prevent cars from exceeding this 20-mile-per-hour limit. But the results were hardly what the planners anticipated. The lower speeds forced cars to travel in second rather than third gear, so they were noisier and produced more exhaust. Shopping trips that used to take only 20 minutes now took 30, so the number of cars in the downtown area at any given time increased markedly. A disaster. No shopping downtown became so nerve-wracking that fewer and fewer people went there. So the desired result was achieved after all. Not really, for even though the volume of traffic gradually went back to its original level, the noise and air pollution remained significant. To make matters worse, during the period of increased traffic, word had gotten around that once-a-week shopping expeditions to a nearby mall on the outskirts of the neighboring town were practical and saved money. More and more people started shopping that way. To the distress of the mayor, downtown businesses that had been flourishing now teetered on the verge of bankruptcy. Tax revenues sank drastically. The master plan turned out to be a major blunder, the consequences of which will burden this community for a long time to come. The fate of this environment-conscious town demonstrates how human planning and decision-making processes can go seriously wrong if we do not pay attention or pay enough attention to possible side effects and long-term repercussions. If we apply corrective measures too aggressively or too timidly, or if we ignore premises we should have considered, effective planning and decision-making were what the physicist and his economic colleague, I'm sorry, I should have said economist colleague, had on their minds this pleasant summer morning as the three of us walked down the hall at the University of Bamberg. The two men had come from a large, well-known industrial enterprise, and their mission was to acquaint themselves with the computer-simulated planning games my colleague and I had in the psychology department. The unspoken assumption in conversations like these and in this simulated world that we have constructed is that we could do much better given the opportunity. However, a couple of hours later, the mood had deteriorated noticeably. The two visitors had, in that period, worked through a planning game. The task was to create better living conditions for a West African tribe of semi-nomads called the Noros. I'm sorry, that's the Moros, who wandered from one watering hole to another in the Sahel region of Africa with their herds of cattle and also raised a little millet. Things were not going particularly well for them. Infant mortality was high and life expectancy was low. Their economy was decimated by repeated famines, tsetse flies that ravaged their cattle, preventing any significant increase in herd size. In short, their situation was dreadful. But now there were solutions, or there seemed to be. Money was available. Measures could be taken against these pests. Deeper wells could be drilled to improve irrigation and allow an expansion of pasture land. Fertilizers and the planting of different strains of millet could improve crop yield. A health service could be established. There was no end to what could be done for this tribe, at least in our computer-simulated world. The economist and the physicist went to work at will. They gathered information, studied the map of the region, asked questions, considered possibilities, rejected one set of plans, developed new ones, and finally reached some decisions that were fed into the computer. The machine then calculated the effect of those decisions. Years sped by in minutes. The computer worked like a kind of time machine. After 20 simulated years and two real hours, the participants politely but unmistakably called each other to task and to the attention that the reports of reduced yields from the wells. The other participant barely disguised annoyance said, "I don't recall that at all." The reason for this clash was the truly dismal state of the tribe, whose standard of living improved at first only to decline again quite rapidly. In the two decades of simulation, the population had doubled thanks to an excellent health care system. Mortality and infant mortality in particular had dropped sharply. Initially, too, there had been a great increase in the number of cattle thanks to successful suppression of the pests. In the same time, the drilling of numerous deep wells made available a rich supply of groundwater that allowed the tribe to enlarge their pasture land radically. Eventually, however, the pasture was no longer able to support the large herds, and overgrazing occurred. The hungry cattle tore up the grass roots, the vegetated land area shrank, and by year 20, hardly any cattle were left because the pasture was almost completely barren. The drilling of still more wells, helpful in the short term, had exhausted the remaining groundwater supply all the more rapidly. The tribe was now in a hopeless situation that could only be alleviated by a massive infusion of outside aid. Okay, so the well-intentioned efforts resulted in disaster or catastrophe. Now, how could this? Now, Dietrich Dorner asked this question: how could this happen? Our two academically trained players were not necessarily specialists in delivering aid to developing countries. On the other hand, they considered themselves quite capable of dealing with the given problem. They drill wells. They set up an effective healthcare system. In short, they solved some immediate problems but did not think about the new problems that solving the old ones would create. They now had to feed a significantly larger population with significantly reduced resources. Everything was much more complicated than before. If no outside help had been available, the result would have been a massive famine. He goes on to say, and I think this is instructive for all of us, and I'm not saying that I would not have made the same mistake either, probably, but it's good to see what we can learn from, in this particular case. This is a simulation of a catastrophe, but nevertheless, it's good for us to consider it. Dorner goes on to say, it appears that very early on, human beings developed a tendency to deal with problems on an ad hoc basis. The task at hand was to gather firewood, to drive a herd of horses into a canyon, or to build a trap for a mammoth. All of these were problems of the moment and usually had no significance beyond themselves. The amount of firewood the members of the Stone Age tribe needed was no more of a threat to the forest than their hunting activity was a threat to wildlife populations. We need to see a problem embedded in the context of other problems. For us, this is the rule, not the exception. Do our habits of thought measure up to the demands of thinking critically or in thinking in systems, one and the same? What errors are we prone to when we have to take side effects and long-term repercussions into account? Okay, so what's the takeaway from this? The takeaway is that we need to first and foremost, before we dive into this effort to fix a problem, we need to first and foremost arm ourselves with the ability to think critically. That's the major takeaway that I have. And once we understand how to think critically, then we can use that going forward to fully and completely define the problem for which we are seeking a solution. And the problem definition or the problem space awareness is another way of saying that is crucial here. If we don't clearly understand the problem, then we're going to go off half-cocked and we're going to probably or most likely make mistakes. And that's the key here. And in fact, that's the key in most everything that we do in terms of problem solving, in terms of trying to understand how best we can perform under conditions that are less than ideal. All right. So we're going to take a quick break, and then we will continue our discussions by talking about Apollo 13. And that's going to help us because there's some really good lessons there because catastrophe was, in fact, avoided in this particular situation. And we're going to learn some important lessons here. See you in just a moment. Okay, welcome back. Now, in Chapter 2, we're going to be talking about Apollo 13. This is a well-known story, I guess, you could say. But there's some interesting takeaways from this particular human endeavor that I think is important for all of us, particularly those of us who want to understand how to think critically in business operations. And again, we use the term business here very loosely. We're also going to be talking about the business of spaceflight and what have you. Apollo 13 was intended to go to the moon. And all of you are familiar with the accident in some form or fashion. But the thing I want to cover here is the amazing problem-solving capabilities of the people who were faced with solving this problem. was really quite remarkable. You know, I wanted to bring this into the show format because here is a great example of some really world-class problem solvers. These problems were enormous. They were the solutions were in many cases way outside the box, and the environment was not only complex, but the environment was extremely hostile to human life, and they were able to successfully return all the whole team, the astronauts and the ground controllers, as well as the support folks, were able to successfully bring back these people alive. Okay, so that is the purpose of this. So let me read a little bit here about the accident to get our minds straight in terms of what exactly happened and how should we consider this and how should we not only applaud these heroes, but also what can we learn about how they were able to solve these very difficult problems. Approaching 56 hours into the mission, Apollo 13 was approximately 200,000 miles from Earth en route to the moon, approximately 6.5 minutes after the end of a live TV broadcast from the spacecraft. One of the astronauts was in the process of closing down the lunar module while the other astronaut was stowing the TV camera. Houston flight controllers asked Swaggart, which is one of the astronauts, to turn on the hydrogen and oxygen tank stirring fans in the service module, which were designed to destratify the chirogenic contents. Okay, the chirogenic, it must be frozen, and increase the accuracy of their quantity readings. Okay, not sure I understand all of that, but let me continue. 2 minutes later, the astronauts heard a pretty large bang, accompanied by fluctuations in electrical power and the firing of the attitude control thrusters. The crew initially thought that a meteor had struck the lunar module. Communications and telemetry to Earth were lost for 1.8 seconds until the system automatically corrected by swerving the high gain S-band antenna used for translunar communications from narrow beam to wide beam mode. Immediately after the bang, one of the astronauts, the commander, reported a problem, and about 3 minutes later, the number one and number three fuel cells failed. Because the fuel cells generated the command and service module's electrical power by combining hydrogen and oxygen into water, then oxygen tank one ran dry. The damage to the service module, and what happened was that the service module's oxygen tank exploded, and the damage made safe return from a lunar landing impossible. So the mission was aborted. And so they were now involved in a return initiative. They had to slingshot around the moon to get back to a return trajectory. And in this process of trying to figure out how to get this space vehicle back safely to Earth, the report says, and they point this out very clearly, considerable ingenuity under extreme pressure was required from the crew, flight controllers, and support personnel for the safe return. The developing drama was shown on television. Because electrical power was severely limited, no more live TV broadcasts were made. TV commentators used models and animated footage as illustrations. Power levels made even voice communications difficult. The lunar module consumables were intended to sustain two people for a day and a half, not three people for 4 days. Oxygen was the least critical consumable because the lunar module carried enough to repressurize the module after surface EVA. The problem was carbon dioxide. The availability of lithium hydroxide for removing carbon dioxide presented a serious problem. Another problem to be solved for a safe return was accomplishing a complete power up from scratch of the completely shut down command module, something never intended to be done in flight. Flight controller John Aaron, with the support of astronaut on the ground Mattingly and other engineers and designers, had to invent a new procedure to do this with the ship's limited power supply and time factor. This was further complicated by the fact that the reduced power levels in the landing module caused internal temperatures to drop as low as 39 degrees Fahrenheit. The unpowered command module got so cold that water began to condense. The last problem to be solved was how to separate the lunar module, how to separate the lunar module a safe distance away from the command module just before reentry. In other words, those two modules had to be separated before atmospheric entry. The normal procedure was to use the service module's reaction control system to pull the command service module away after releasing the lunar module along with the command module's docking ring. But this mechanism was inoperative because the power failure and the useless service module would be released before the landing module. To solve the problem, the contractor, Grumman, called on the engineering expertise of the University of Toronto. A team of six UT engineers led by senior scientist Bernard Etkin was formed to solve the problem within a day. The team concluded that pressurizing the tunnel connecting the lunar module to the command module just before separation would provide the force necessary to push the two modules a safe distance away from each other just prior to reentry. The team had 6 hours to compute the pressure required using slide rules. They needed an accurate calculation as to how a pressure might damage the hatch in its seal, causing the astronauts to burn up. Too low a pressure would not provide enough separation distance of the lunar module. Grumman relayed their calculations to NASA, and from there, in turn, to the astronauts who were able to use it successfully. Now, that's problem solving under extreme pressure, and that's an example of what we are capable of doing, and then an example really for all of us. If we can actually, you know, as humans, as professionals, if we can actually do such a thing, then we ought to be able to solve even the most daunting business problem, if we can actually do such a thing. So here, the takeaway for me is that the problem solving under complex situations or under extreme time compression or both mission critical problem solving, it's all possible. We can do such a thing, and we ought to be confident in our abilities to do so. And one of the things that I'd like to think about here is, are we prepared? Have we prepared ourselves sufficiently to handle these, these complex problems, to handle these situations, these mission critical situations? Are we prepared to handle them effectively and with confidence? And if the answer is, well, we're not sure, then what should we be doing beforehand? What should we be doing before we encounter such a thing? Are we going to say, let's rely on luck. Let's assume that we're not going to have to deal with things like that, that our days will be mostly routine, and we'll try to get by with that. But I don't think that's going to work. I don't think that that's going to be something that that we can rely on for the length of someone's working life or someone's career. I do think that we're going to encounter situations and problems that are daunting. And are we equipped to deal with that? And so here we have a wonderful example of problem solving under extreme pressure in an environment that is so unforgiving as to be space. And they were able to figure out a solution. Reentry and splashdown of the Apollo 13. As Apollo 13 neared Earth, the crew first jettisoned the service module using the landing module's reaction control system to pull themselves a safe distance from it, instead of the normal procedure, which used automatic firing of the service module's reaction control system. They photographed it for later analysis of the accident cause. It was then that the crew was surprised to see for the first time that the entire Sector 4 panel had been blown off. According to the analysis, these pictures also showed the antenna damage and possibly an upward tilt to the fuel cell shelf above the oxygen tank compartment. Finally, the crew jettisoned the lunar module Aquarius using the above procedure worked out at the University of Toronto, leaving the command module Odyssey to begin its lone reentry through the atmosphere. The reentry on a lunar mission normally was accomplished by about 4 minutes of typical communication blackout caused by ionization of the air around the command module. The blackout in Apollo 13's reentry lasted 6 minutes, which was 87 seconds longer than had been expected. The possibility of heat shield damage from the O2 tank rupture heightened the tension of the blackout period. Odyssey regained radio contact and splashed down safely in the South Pacific Ocean, southeast of American Samoa. The crew was in good condition, except for one of the astronauts who suffered from a serious infection because of insufficient water intake. All right, so that's about that. That's the conclusion of Apollo 13 as a case lesson of how we can actually rise to the occasion and to perform extraordinarily well in conditions that were unexpected, but were very difficult and life-threatening, and we were able to save lives, and we were able to, while the actual mission was aborted, we were able to recover. The recovery turned out to be successful. All right, so we're going to take a short break, and we're going to continue on with our next area of interest, which is the Space Shuttle Challenger accident. Okay, welcome back to Throttle Up. This is a special edition, of course, and we're going to continue with our discussion. We're going to be talking, at least presenting the first installment of the Space Shuttle Challenger accident and catastrophe. And the reason why we're doing this is not because we're proposing that we could have done a better job. We are doing this, of course, so that we can learn. We can all learn from these unfortunate events that have occurred, and as a group of professionals, it really behooves us to take these lessons seriously, to learn in a conscientious way. Okay, so. The Challenger, the Space Shuttle Challenger, the Rogers Commission report that was the accident report, was created by Presidential Commission charged with investigating the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster during its 10th mission. The report released and submitted to President Ronald Reagan on June 9th, 1986, both determined that the cause of the disaster that took place 73 seconds after liftoff, and urged NASA to improve and install new safety features on the shuttles and in its organizational handling of future missions. The commission found that the Challenger accident was caused by a failure in the O-ring seal that left, the O-rings sealing the aft field joint on the right solid rocket booster, causing pressurized gases and eventually flame to blow by the O-ring and contact the adjacent external tank, causing structural failure. The failure of the O-ring was attributed to a design flaw, as their performance could be too easily compromised by factors including the low temperature on the day of launch. They further went on to say that this is an accident rooted in history. The report says that more broadly, it was determined the contributing cause of the accident were the failures of both NASA and its contractors to respond adequately to the design flaw. The commission found that as early as 1977, the managers had not only known about the flawed O-ring, but that it had the potential for catastrophe. This led the Rogers Commission to conclude that the Challenger disaster was an accident rooted in history. The accident report also strongly criticized the decision-making process that led to the launch of the Challenger, saying it was seriously flawed. There was a meeting the night before the launch to discuss any major pressing issues that might delay the launch further. Several of the contract engineers stated their concerns about the O-ring and urged a delay, but the concerns didn't get communicated beyond the Level 3 flight readiness review. It is certain that even though the members of higher flight readiness review teams knew about the issues, there was plenty of members who could have stopped the launch but decided not to. This was done in large part because of the management structure at NASA and the lack of major checks and balances, which proved to be fatal in this scenario. The report concluded that failures in communication resulted in a decision to launch based on incomplete and sometimes misleading information, a conflict between engineering data and management judgments, and a management structure that permitted internal flight safety problems to bypass key shuttle managers. Now, next week we'll be talking about, we'll continue this discussion next week in part four of our special edition, Critical Thinking and Business Operations. And what I want to do is I want to spend some quality time on the role of Richard Feynman in the accident investigation of the Challenger and his contributions, which I think were pretty significant. I know he came under some criticism, but I do think that his contributions to the understanding and the underlying causes of this catastrophe are very, very significant, and we should take them very seriously, because he had a lot of things to say that I believe were particularly important for all of us to understand, and really to understand in a way that's meaningful for us, not just for spaceflight, but really for any endeavor that involves complexity and challenges that we are confronted with. Well, that went fast. So this is a close of another show, another Throttle Up. And before I go, I would like to acknowledge a few people. I'd like to thank my listening audience for being here. And I would like to thank Red State Talk Radio for providing us an opportunity for each and every weekend to put on this radio show that we call Throttle Up. And I would like to thank all of you veterans out there. Thank you for your service. And I would like to thank the families of the veterans. Thank you for supporting this noble cause. And I would like to thank all of you on active duty in the Guard and the Reserve. Thank you for serving this great country of ours. And with that, I would like to say goodbye, and we will see you all again next week.